Welcome to A Piece of My Mind, a podcast that uses storytelling to bridge divides and build community. Today I'm talking with Duncan Gray in Oxford, Mississippi. Duncan is a retired Episcopal priest and was the ninth bishop of the Episcopal Diocese of Mississippi. I met him at St. Peter's Church in Oxford, where he was rector like his father before him. His father served from 1957 to 1965, during the turbulent era when James Meredith was the first black man who was allowed admission into the University of Mississippi. St. Peter's organized itself in 1851. The church building was completed just prior to the Civil War in 1860. Its first service was just before Mississippi's secession, and according to Duncan, has a history of being an enlightened community in some pretty difficult times in Mississippi.
I'm Duncan Gray. I'm a retired Episcopal priest and bishop of the Diocese of Mississippi. We are in Oxford, Mississippi at St. Peter's Episcopal Church.
And tell me a little bit about the history of this church.
Well, this church was, congregation was founded or organized itself in 1851. It was completed just prior to the Civil War in 1860. The first service was just prior to secession. And through the years, it's been a remarkable place in all kinds of ways, and has a history, particularly in the 1940s on, of being an enlightened community in some pretty difficult, dark times in Mississippi. It housed the first, what became the first special education program in the state of Mississippi. It was a Head Start community in some difficult times. A congregation here initiated and created the first low-income housing project in Oxford. It was where my father was, as he, prior to some of that, was involved in trying to keep a lid on the anger around the integration, and provided some leadership when the university was in great turmoil.
Let's actually pause there for a second and talk about that a little bit. You're talking about the integration of the University of Mississippi when James Meredith was first
Correct. Attending
in 60...
The 1962 is when he entered the university. The efforts through the courts preceded that by a year or so. And all during that time, my dad preached about the need to open the doors and allow this man to enter. As it worked its way through the court system, his sermons became a little bit more pointed. I remember vividly his sermon the Sunday before Meredith officially entered and the riots took place Sunday evening. I remember the sermon following the riots, pretty significant milestones in this congregation, in this city, and in this state. But Dad did it in the context of a community, as I was trying to suggest, had a history of some pretty significant work in social outreach. Now, it didn't mean things were easy. About half the congregation left.
Well, I was going to say, that's a difficult time in our history for a white man in church leadership to say some of those things.
Yeah.
Did he talk about that at all?
Well, he was a kind and gentle man, and part of the reason the church, in the midst of all of that, held together was he never quit loving the folks who hated him. And one of his mottos, more than a motto, I mean, he lived it, was if you hate those who hate you, they've won. and he refused to go that route. So he would be prophetic in his ministry and then go make a call on the folks who got upset the next day. So that was the model that I grew up with. So he talked about it, and yes, our dinner time conversations were probably a little bit different. My siblings remember all kinds of things he said over dinner. You know, we talked politics, which was fascinating in the Mississippi in the 1950s and 1960s. Mm-hmm. Talked about the good guys and the bad guys, but it was an important part of my formation as a child.
What do you remember him saying around the dinner table? What's a formative lesson that you learned there?
Terribly important part, as I said, was his willingness to stay connected to people with whom you disagreed. And I remember him many times shaking his head over what somebody had said or done, and said words to the effect, "But Duncan, God loves them, and I do too." And so when crosses were burned in our front yard, or
in your front yard,
the threatening phone calls were an important part of our common life. We were taught how to respond to the threats on the phone. One time he said, we were talking about somebody who called and just said some terrible things to my mother and threatened to kill each one of us by name, us children. Dad said something to the effect, he's got a lot of problems, probably got children of his own. You know, he humanized all these folks that I would be tempted as an adolescent to demonize. That stayed with me forever.
You alluded to the fact before we started the interview that the history of this church, that as you look at it, that there in the founding of it, that there's a really good chance that most of those founding members had been slave owners. And I wonder if you can talk about how this church has tried to reconcile that through the years.
Well, that's relatively new information. This report we had is just the beginning of a process in which we are trying to figure out how to use that information. It was general knowledge that it was probably built by slaves, but the extent to which slavery and the wealth generated by slavery and the labor, all of which the wealth and the labor created this, is something that we're going to be intentional about dealing with. We just began that conversation last night in this meeting. Some ideas that we're wrestling with is there's one family, the Gies family, that was the major slave owner in the community, probably a major funder, and maybe some of the Gies slaves actually built this. That could have been McGee's fingerprint out there on the front that I mentioned. In Lafayette County now, there are no white McGee's, but there are tons of African American McGee's, descendants of the slaves of Mr. McGee's. So, what does that mean? You know, what does it mean in 2021? Is there a way, for instance, that this church could sponsor a scholarship, a college scholarship to Ole Miss for descendants of those slaves? That's just at the early beginning. But the bigger picture with that is that we're aware that we are not unique in this story. Churches that were built in this era, in this community and elsewhere, have very similar stories. Our country is wrestling with the macro story of all of this. And is there a way in which we, by intention, can say we're not special but we are looking at a way to walk through this moment with some integrity and intentionality and be creative and maybe be an example that encourages others to do something like this. We're not going to take down stained glass windows or anything like that. Is there a way in which we can take our history, remembering what my dad had said, you know, these were human beings trying to do the best they could. They were very wrong about some very important things. That's what Dad used to say in the 50s and 60s. Can we take that history and find ways to bless the good and redeem the bad? That, to me, is kind of the challenge of this moment.
Yeah, it's a complex issue, and I'm curious, there are some who are not so interested in having that conversation, some who are resisting that process. What would you say to try to bring them into the conversation?
Well, the first thing, I think, is to deal with facts. In my own journey over the last couple of years, related to this statue that you're talking about, is to realize that as enlightened of families that I was brought up in all kinds of ways, and different from so much of my peers in Mississippi, I still breathed in so much of the lost cause that it shaped and formed me in ways that were subtle and subconscious. My own last two or three years process has been to discern facts and not legend and not mythology. And that's been unsettling. And so for me to have had that recent experience of facts unsettling me and making me rethink some things, I think I can do that with folks with some sensitivity. I grew up in this town, and that statue didn't bother me whatsoever. You know, it was history. It was a particularly difficult time and a time when we were on the wrong side of history, but it was. It wasn't until the facts of when it was erected, why it was erected, the language around its development and erection, and the work I've been doing with April Grayson, and the language that was used to promote the statue was the same language that was used to justify lynchings. Incredible overlap. Timing was remarkably similar. All of those things begin to come together for me in a pretty dramatic way, and in addition to some personal reading I've been doing. So, point being is I've just recently taken this journey and is still on this journey, and so I can understand how well-meaning, good folks can be historically blind to certain realities, not because they're bad people, but because we all have breathed in the lore of the lost cause.
You know, it was interesting. Yesterday there was a man, he was in his late 40s. He came to share just a short story at the statue for the studio series we're doing. And his response was to what does a statue mean to you? His response was, I'm sorry that it took me 47 years to understand the pain that this caused to my brothers and sisters. As much as I've been trying to be involved in these conversations and consider these issues, on almost a daily basis, I'm feeling my eyes opened a little bit more to other people's experiences and understanding what some of this history that I've been taught in the country looks like from a different perspective.
There was one fellow. He was actually a state senator when Mississippi was considering changing its state flag. because it had the Confederate emblem. And this fellow said, I think he was Senator Blackmun from Canton, when I walk into the chambers of the Senate, I notice that flag in ways that my colleagues who are white don't. And I know that's true, but I'm just telling you, I see it differently, and it affects me every time I walk into this chamber. I was aware that that's exactly my experience with not so much the flag. That had, because the rebel Confederate banner had been waved in hate all during my childhood. I knew that was problematic. But the statue, I had used the language we're using these days, I had the privilege of not noticing it. My great uncle was a significant regional artist here, John McCready, and he painted the statue in as a background to a lot of his paintings, and it never, it's part of the scenery.
Yeah, never even registered it.
And never registered until the past few years.
You mentioned something about seeing that rebel banner waved in hate through your youth at times. Can you, you suggested that there were crosses that burned on your front yard. Can you talk about some of those other experiences you had as a young person that may have sort of shaped your understanding of how your faith calls you toward healing?
Well, I begin with my dad's examples as a reference. And one of the remarkable things about my childhood was how normal it was. I had friends who were disagreed with my dad, and certainly their parents did. But I was a pretty good athlete, so I stayed connected because I felt that I could hit a curveball.
They wanted you on the team.
Tackle a running back or something like that. But there were times that I remember vividly when the rebel flag that I initially saw as just part of the symbolism of the football team, you know, a marker for the football team. When, as things intensified around 1962, it became a defiant symbol. A friend of mine, a pastor down at Second Baptist Church, talked about as a sharecropper's child on Highway 6 and the people come into the football games, shaking the rebel flag at this little 8-year-old boy, you know, in defiance. And certainly it evolved during that period. And I knew very clearly that this was an act of defiance. It was, in individual cases, an act of hate. And it became a sign and a symbol for what I saw was everything wrong in Mississippi, particularly around its racial attitudes. The most poignant moment was being a big football fan. I listened to every Ole Miss football game as a little boy, and the ones that I could go to, I did. And Ole Miss was playing the University of Kentucky the Saturday before the riot down in Jackson. And Ross Barnett had been a symbol of resistance through all those years.
This is the riot after James Meredith.
Yeah, this is prior. Yeah, this was the Saturday night before Meredith entered on Sunday, and the riots took place Sunday night. And Governor Barnett stood in front of this crowd at Memorial Coliseum in Jackson. And I was listening on the radio. See, I love Mississippi. I love the people of Mississippi. I love the customs of Mississippi. And as an eighth grader, I got scared because I'd seen enough of the Nazi rallies with Hitler. I called my dad in and said, listen to this. He got worried. The later photos I saw of that, was that rebel flag was you know, going crazy, the individual rebel flags. Of course, in those days, the Ole Miss band had the largest Confederate flag in the world. You know, they would run out on the... And by that point, it was no longer an innocent symbol. It was a symbol of resistance, though they would deny it, symbol of hate. So that flag, I was never confused about it from that point on. I was 13 at the time. There was one particular moment when my dad was coaching me in Little League baseball, and we were leaving late at night and from the game, the lights were being cut off. Small group confronted my dad about some personnel decisions on the team. Eventually got bigger. It became a real threatening moment, and dad was spit on, and he sort of quietly ushered me out of the crowd, and we went home, and I got all upset. He didn't fight back, and that was when he first said to me, Duncan, if you hate those who hate you, they've won. So I had it crystallized in a moment. Apologize, I'm sorry you had to deal with that. Why didn't you stand up and fight like a man? Those were two times that really stand out in my mind, that I was caught up in hate. Now, Dad dealt with it on a daily basis.
I want to back up a little bit to when the governor was standing in front of the crowd at that football game, and he, if I understand the history correct, so he was getting them sort of riled up, and then he publicly opposed James Meredith.
He had been opposing the integration for a year. This was kind of the climax. Even while publicly he was opposing it and fanning the flames of defiance of federal government, he was negotiating behind the scenes, as it's been documented, with Robert Kennedy, among others, as to how to make this happen so he wouldn't lose face with all the people that he had, you know, had riled up. And they were rolling with Ross. Let's roll with Ross. He primarily created this tinderbox that ultimately produced the resistance for the months and years and the riot. He was at the center of it all.
As we look at the history, have grown up in the Christian faith and embrace it, but as I look at the history, I see a community of faith leaders who have worked to support others, who have worked to fight for civil rights, who have been in that movement. But at the same time, I look at the history of the church, and I see many times where it has supported the institution of slavery. It has been on that other side of history, and you said an interesting quote before we started the interview that your mom shared with you. I wonder if we can talk about that dichotomy of how the Christian faith in particular has moved through the world.
Well, the Christian faith has been the best of influences and the worst of influences, to paraphrase. Part of growing up in the Deep South was to see both functions of the church. There were clearly churches that were points of great resistance to social change. Still are. What I always had to remind myself, usually not me, but my father, was that we don't want churches not to be resistant, because that's part of the faithfulness in some eras. In some parts of our history, we have needed the church to be resistant and wished it had been more resistant, like the Lutheran Church in Germany had been more resistant to social moments of change. So that part of the faith's DNA, we don't want to eliminate. But the discernment of when is the moment to resist and when is the moment to lead in moving in a new direction. Those are critical and not always easily discernible decisions. And so, you know, growing up in Mississippi in the 1950s and 60s, the Episcopal Church, as a rule, was very progressive in matters of race. Now, that's a relative term. You know, what was progressive in 1954 would not be seen quite as progressive in 2021. But relatively speaking, it was a very progressive community. And wherever I went in the church, either with youth events or with adults, there was that sense that I was in a community that was working for change, particularly in the area of racial reconciliation. That's how I was shaped. Just, again, it was the community. Kind of like other things in Christian faith. Faith is more easily caught than taught. And I caught that element of the faith through the community that I was a part of. When I went to seminary, I wasn't able to identify it quite the same way, but till later. But I went to seminary to be an agent of social change. My spirituality was rather thin. My sense of liturgy was non-existent. But I had seen both my dad and others in the middle of social action. And that's what I wanted to do. And the vehicle seemed to be the church. My two career choices when I graduated from college was go to seminary or be a civil rights attorney, both of which had been significant models for me growing up.
Just depends on which book of the law you're going to follow, I suppose.
Yeah, so if you're faithful, you're going to take some personal risk, and chances are you're not going to be wonderfully popular. But that was just was a given, and so when those things happened to me, it was no big deal. It's what I anticipated. Now, I was pretty arrogant. I was enormously self-righteous. The years helped me to be a little bit more humble and a little bit less self-righteous, though that's my Achilles heel. That's how I came into faith. Faith for me as a formative moment in my adolescence and beyond the social action. It took me a while to deepen that faithfulness to spiritual relationship to God and my Lord. Those things evolved.
So draw an overt connection between those two. How does, as you've matured in your faith, how does your faith call you to that social action?
Part of my maturing brought me full circle to understand what my dad was saying. And that was this, what I would describe as my enemy, the beloved child of God. Part of my faithfulness is to see that person through the eyes of God. And so the relationship, the intimacy that grew over time in my faith allowed me, I think, in my best moments, to be able never to see the other as an it, but always a thou, and a bearer of the image of Christ, whether that was language they would use or not. It was my faith perspective that helped me to stay connected, again, coming full circle to things that my dad said that I didn't quite understand.
Yeah, there's an exercise that, and I don't remember where I learned this, but I imagine you've heard it as well. I think it was in reading lessons from a rabbi whose name I don't recall, but the exercise of walking down the street and just looking at everybody as they pass and say, there's a child of God, and there's a child of God, and there's a child of God. And whether, again, whether or not that person you're passing would recognize that connection or not, it is formative in your perspective of the world that you're walking through.
Part of the things that worked on me when I was a parish priest that I missed as a bishop was that when someone came to the altar for communion and held their hands out, in this church in particular, where I spent most of my time, I knew what they needed. Now, I knew they needed the body of our Lord and that presence in their life, but I knew the particulars because I knew the people. And there was this sense that their vulnerability in saying, I need the sacrament, I need this. I knew the particulars in their lives because I was their pastor. That knowledge, I knew when somebody was filled with hate and they came to the altar reluctantly to receive the sacrament from me, and I knew what they needed, and I wanted, and I prayed to be a part of the healing of what they needed. There was this part in my mind, Lord, make me an instrument of your peace. Just in this very simple act that I was doing, and use me as these folks need you. And that grew to be very important to me. Now, when I became bishop, and I would go to a different church every Sunday, do the same thing, but I wasn't in that intimacy of relationship. I missed that terribly in my sacramental role.
Yeah, I think there is something about being in that close relationship and understanding the vulnerabilities. And I think that sometimes in our modern world, we don't have that opportunity to be in that kind of close relationship with human beings. And I think that there's all manner of ills that creep out of that lack of connection.
Which is part of the tragedy of this current moment when we're dealing with COVID. Those things that some of us are hesitant to do anyway, out of our introverted nature, you know, are just suddenly multiplied by the restrictions that we've placed on ourselves for good reason. I worry about implications for going forward as we lost some of that intimacy and connection. I hugged my grandchildren last month for the first time in a year. And just was tearing. But anyway, that's a separate issue.
Well, I'm not sure that it is a separate issue. I think that I worry as well that we will have forgotten how to be in community, that we will have forgotten how to be close. And my hope is that in some way yet to be determined, a piece of my mind and our programming and our working with communities can help to rediscover that and rekindle that.
I've wondered, is it simply coincidental that we've reached the tipping point around race in the year of COVID disconnect? I don't know what the relationship is.
Well, now I've played with that a little bit in my mind too, because of course I'm from Minneapolis, And so I had been traveling and programming so much for A Piece of My Mind that I would have typically been on the road when George Floyd was killed. I happened to be home like everybody else, and idle because of COVID. I think perhaps in that process of us being idle, slowing down, and having the space to consider a lot of things and a lot of priorities and a lot of importance in our lives, that then this large and public event happened. You know, we tend to have a short attention span as human beings, and so when these sorts of things have happened in the past, there's been a response, but then quickly people get pulled back to their work routine and the next wedding and the next funeral that they need to attend. There was a space to really consider this in ways that we've not had the opportunity before. And so I would concur with you that perhaps these are related.
Mm-hmm. Need for historians down the road to
parse
that out.
Yeah. Right. This is a fascinating conversation. I'm curious, before we close, in your years of wisdom and your experience, what else have you learned that you think the world desperately needs to recall at this moment in history?
Well, I mentioned it a couple of times, but I think we need to give each other the benefit of the doubt more than we do, turning a blind eye to things. I had a little sign that when I was bishop, you know, that I had, I pull it out of my desk on one of those little drawers there.
To remind yourself?
To remind myself, and it's what it said was, don't attribute to malice what can be adequately explained by ignorance, incompetence, or stupidity. And I found that very, very helpful because it related to something else that over the years I've come to believe, and that unless someone is pathologically ill, most of us are trying to do the best we can. Now, that doesn't mean we're right. And there are times when somebody's doing the best they can and they're terribly wrong. So it doesn't remove the judgment issues and discernment issues. But if we can understand that most folks, within their capacity, are doing the best they can with life, then it's easier for me to see them as fragile, imperfect human beings, just like me. In the work that I was doing with April around the lynching memorials, I had conversations with several of the supervisors that I think ultimately were helpful. That's what I brought into these, that these were not bad guys. They may have been wrong on some important issues to me, but they were doing the best they could. And is there a way in which I can help them do what I wanted to do? And we had a breakthrough moment when one of our young African-American women on this task force allowed the supervisors to do that, allowed them to talk about their concerns at a deeper level than had been done, and their concerns about being seen as recalcitrant white guys. And there was a breakthrough in that interchange in a Zoom meeting that allowed us to do what we were trying to do. But it was just remarkable, and she led the way.
As you talk about this, it sounds a lot like you're talking about grace.
Absolutely. As long as I'm self-righteous, I don't need grace, and the other person doesn't need grace. They just need to get right. When I find a little bit more humility in my own see the other as a similar broken human being.
That sounds like a model that we'd do good to wash across the whole country right about. Well, sir, I appreciate your time. Thank you for sharing a little bit of your thoughts with me, and thank you.
Glad to be of help.